Drep Scott for coming in with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 says Love and Light JCD. And closing us off today, Sir Brindlehorse came in with $8.88, was on the same wavelength as Gwiff the Cock, who was over in the troll room, noagenda.stream. Get there now. And they wanted to hear this song because we know JCD collected it on 45. How many? Don't know. But a lot of people have covered it. Even if you don't know the words, sing along.
Let's go!
Yeah, we do gotta go. Thanks, Meemaw, for the 2,000 sat boost. You said, what a beautiful tribute, and long live JCD. Say hi to CJ Eureka when you get to heaven. That is going to do it for a special edition of the No Agenda Rock and Roll Pre-Show. Thanks to everybody for tuning in, requesting songs, supporting the show, and yes, trolling along. It is all very much appreciated. Get your requests in now. We'll honor JCD some more, show some more love on the next show, RNR.show. But it is now time for the Irish Wake, the big event, the big show, the power at the top of the hour, the media deconstruction that you need to function. They're always given every ounce because every second counts. They're the hard-hitting, noble-shitting, truth-spraying, jingle-playing, future-telling, insanity-quelling, groundbreaking, ring-stick-shaking, troll-baiting, media-berating, critical-thinking, teaching, value-for-value, preaching, baggy-trouser-wearing, been trying to stop swearing, and alleviating your fears for over 18 years. I will be back on Sunday to pump the wattage into your cottage, blast the bass all over your face, stream the bits and bytes for the dames and knights, and the rest of you trolls out in Gitmo Nation. But until then, I am Darren O'Neill. These are my last few words. Take it away, Chef.
You are listening to the No Agenda Stream, where freedom lives and censorship comes to get its ass kicked.
Keep it right here. Lock it in and rip the knob off.
I love getting up in the morning to Darren O'Neill. Who the fuck is that?
Yo, Chef, thank you very much. Excellent rock and roll pre-show in the morning to you trolls. You are connected directly to the heart of the Texas Hill Country.
Ladies and gentlemen, please rise for your Gitmo Nation national anthem.
Get up and sing.
In the morning, Gitmo Nation, we are all charged up to be human resources and servants in all lands and all ships at sea. From the east to west, down under to the lowlands and beyond, we are happy and distracted slaves. Hear our Gitmo Nation song.
And in the morning to all the trolls in the troll room, we got a lot right now today. It's good to see everybody. Wow, are you ready for this show? Let's let everybody out there in Gitmo Nation know with the bat signal. There it is. Retweet the tweet, boost the tune, slash the X, wine on the blue cry, spin a reel, and do something stupid on the TikTok. Episode 1888 of the best podcast in the universe. Your No Agenda Show is next. for one time only, I will say, hit it.
Scam, this whole thing.
Life is a scam.
This thing is a scam.
Life is a scam.
Everybody's in on the scheme, this whole thing.
Death and destruction. Life is a scam.
This thing is a scam, this whole thing.
Life is a scam.
Life is a scam. Life is a scam.
This thing is a scam. Scam. Scam.
Adam Curry, John C. Dvorak.
It's Thursday, July 23rd, 2026. This is your award-winning Gitmo Nation Media Assassination, episode 1888.
This is No Agenda.
Well, with the passing of John C. Dvorak, I think it's only fitting that I declare July 20th a national holiday in the honor of John, the co-creator of the best podcast in the universe.
Welcome to episode 1888 of the best podcast in the universe, your No Agenda show. Family, today I have a hole in my heart you could turn a 747 around in. John C. Dvorak, my friend, my business partner, my comedic counterpart, my all-time favorite broadcaster, is no longer here to share the joy of what we love to do twice a week on Thursdays. Almost 19 years ago, we decided to hit record on conversations we were having when I was living in London and John in San Francisco. We discussed the news, me on my side looking through the Financial Times or the British tabloids, John on his side looking through the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. We talked about technology, we talked about cooking, we talked about our lives. We didn't know if anyone really found it interesting, but we didn't care. We were just recording it because, well, hey, maybe someone out there would enjoy listening. From the very first show, we promised that this podcast would never have jingles, commercials, bips and boops, sound effects, anything basically standard broadcast, and boy, were we wrong. We also never had listeners. From the early episodes, we decided that in order to make this work financially without staff, everybody would have to be a producer, contributing their time, talent, and treasure. We called ourselves media deconstructionists, but really, we were just trying to impress each other, make each other laugh with the things we found or the punchlines we would deliver to each other. Since John passed, I've been listening to older shows, trying to pick clips, which is just virtually impossible. Because every single show had something magic in it. Even our notorious arguments were beauty in itself. We always felt that when people were uncomfortable listening to us argue or kvetch, that it was like mom and dad having a fight. And to us as broadcasters, that was a success. Because we touch people emotionally the same way as if we'd made them laugh. Now, don't get me wrong. We always wanted to make people laugh. Without even ever having discussed it, we both felt that looking at the world around us, the news that shoved in our face, most of it not true, or merely to promote some other entertainment product, having the ability to look through it all and laugh at it would make the world a better place for our family, our No Agenda family, No Agenda Nation. John was the most unique man I'd ever met. The first time I ever spoke with him was on an episode of TWiT, audio only. We were both remote, I think, and at the end, there was a little bit of chatter off air, and John said, "Hey, Curry, what's your deal? Are you rich, or what's going on with that?" I said, "Why don't we have lunch? I'll tell you all about it." That was the beginning of a long friendship and partnership. The most beautiful thing about John is that we had complete trust in each other. The division of work, the consistency, even in business, the entire operation was based on a handshake. Even though the IRS later made us form an LLC because they couldn't understand what all these $3.33 checks and cash about coming in every single week. We rarely spoke outside of the show. Maybe if a server was down or something had happened that would affect business process, we might have a short text, email, or a phone call. We never discussed what we're going to do on the show. Everything was completely unscripted. And this is the point I really want to make. This wasn't just a show. It was a performance. It was not Adam and John just bringing clips in with their opinion. It was like a dance. Imagine that, having the privilege to dance with John for 6 hours a week. We stepped on each other's toes sometimes, but we always kept dancing until the band was done playing. John may be a better broadcaster too. His timing was impeccable. He even compensated for network delay in the early days of Skype, and we got into a rhythm where I would start the clip when his lead-in was done. It was smooth most of the time. Like thousands of others, he taught me how to question everything, even the absurd,
which would often require a theremin. Above all, he made me a better man. I once tried to tell him how he was kind of like a father figure to me in many ways, which he immediately shunned and said, "Don't ever say that again." Okay, then maybe uncle, grandfather, brother, whatever it was, I am privileged to have had him in my life for the past two decades. Many people came to know No Agenda during COVID, which we had quickly figured out to be some epic scam. And as we worked through it with our humor, it gave a lot of people rest and a feeling that they were not alone. And while I know many of you came for the media deconstruction, pretty much everybody stayed for the stories and the wealth of history that John had and the jokes we would make together. After each show, the end of show ISO would run, we'd probably say something like, "Hey, that was a good show." And John would always say, "Yeah, solid B+. I would look for the opening clips, which is always funny to do, listen to whatever nonsense John had spouted out. Then we'd select the art, which we argued about often, but that wasn't too bad. We'd check the credits together, and we'd come up with a title. And he didn't have to, but John always stayed there for my final post-production, uploading to the servers, getting the show notes in order. It took 20, 25 minutes. He's just basically waiting, only hearing me clacking on the keyboard. When everything was up and good to go, we always said the same thing. "Okay, talk to you Thursday. Adios." And that's exactly how last Sunday ended. Here's the good part for me. Oftentimes when someone is removed from life, you think of the things you could have said to that person, the things you wanted to say to that person. I am so fortunate because not only did I get to say it, I did. And he said everything he wanted and needed to say to me as well. It was all on the show. Never behind the scenes. What you heard was the real deal. We both loved how No Agenda Nation grew. The community, the lingo, the different websites, the numerology, the inside jokes, the code words, the small family businesses that supported the show with their funny notes and their crazy promo codes, the meetups. Oh man, the meetups. We love this so much because it showed us that the show was bigger than just Adam and John. John took care of the business side of things, backed by his wonderful family, Mimi, Jay, Eric, JC. Everyone contributed. The newsletter, which we have often told other podcasters, is probably the most important business part of the show because we depend on your support. And whenever John said donations are low or threw a sad puppy, it was never a lie. It was always the honest truth. And he was never ashamed to tell you and ask you to help for us. And you did. These past few days have been quite overwhelming. The social media posts, the thousands of emails, stories, and yes, many prayers. And not just people saying thoughts and prayers, real prayer. Reading through as many as I could, replying to as many as I possibly could, I kept seeing one theme. People would never say, "Hey, remember when you deconstructed that story or you poked through that narrative?" No. It was always about the humor and the stories. I was blown away when just a few shows ago I learned about yet another job that John had had in the past. He was a never-ending, deep well of beautiful, hilarious, and informative life stories. But there's more in these messages from our producers. There's a feeling of community, a sense of family, coming together with love for each other. And ask yourself, did you even think about the war in Iran during these past 24 hours? I sure haven't. It wasn't that kind of the point of what John brought us. A way to look at things from a different perspective, a somewhat laissez-faire attitude because it made you feel that he had seen it all before and nothing was new under the sun. And he's right. It's clear that No Agenda will never be the same without John. This family, this community that we built with him is too big and too vast to end. And while I'm not exactly sure how we will move forward from here without him, today and on Sunday's show, just like any family, we will honor the man who we loved, who we cherished, who we laugh with, and all valued as being part of our lives. My only prayer now for today is that John is in heaven saying, "Crap, Adam was right." See you on the other side, John. Love you. Mean it.
To see you someday in the morning. I'm gonna miss you in the morning. You're always there for me in the morning. Someday in the morning, in the morning.
And just for the recording, I'm going to play that one more time because it got messed up somewhere. I don't know why it's getting messed up. Don't do this to me. Hold on. Let's get this straight. Hold on. Of course, the enemy comes in and does that to me, doesn't he? Where are we here? Let's try this now.
Woke up this morning singing a new song. Everything has changed. Walking around the same old world. It's never gonna be the same. But in my heart and in my mind, I'll keep you there to stay. I'm gonna miss you in the morning. You're always there for me in the morning. I hope to see you someday in the morning.
On today's episode, we have a lot of John's friends and family. We also have a lot of donation notes, which we will be reading. I'd like to say first in the morning to Mimi, who is standing by right now. Mimi?
I'm right here.
Yes.
You just destroyed me with your beautiful words.
It destroyed my whole system.
I know.
John's up there going, Curry, can't you get anything right? Can't you get that stuff to fire off right?
No, he's screwing with stuff. I'm sure of it.
Yes. So the first thing I just want to say is that one of the most polarizing things of the announcement of John's passing is a secret that I've had to keep for almost 20 years. And I would like you to explain it to everybody because, I got people saying, Wikipedia's fake news. What's going on? They was like very, very disturbed by this.
Well, John, when he was starting to feel his age of 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it had to be 30 years ago, he decided he was doing some interview for some, maybe it was Wired, maybe it was something else. And they said, oh, how old are you? And he goes, well, I was born in. And he told me he was, so he came up with a date. Except when he first told me this, he was going to be 2 years younger than me. And I had a fit. Going, you're not going to be younger than me. So he changed it to, 52. And so he told this, this interviewer that year. And then something happened, and he was in the New York Times, I'd say, about 6 months later, and the New York Times didn't fact check and just picked up that day.
Exactly.
And we went, well, if the New York Times says it, who are we to argue with the New York Times, who always checks facts?
I don't know how I found out, but he said, no, you got to keep that a secret. And he literally would tell me, if I die before you, you have to tell everybody the New York Times sucks, they don't fact check, and they were wrong. And so every year when his birthday would come around, and we did a special birthday number donation for both of us, I would always say, hey man, if only you weren't lying, we'd make more money out of this.
I know.
It was our running joke.
It got really awkward. I mean, there was that thing where I actually mentioned when I was doing the show that it was, his high school. And I said, oh, we got to take that out because someone can look up the yearbook and see. So we guarded
that's
it carefully.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. The yearbook, got to get rid of that. I can't have that published anywhere. It was one of the oddest things. It was just so, so strange.
Oh, well, the other things that the New York Times picked up is that he was born in L.A. because he thought that was funnier because he was actually born in Fresno.
Love that. we can hear a couple people laughing on the clean feed, and we have a number of John's friends with us. I'm just going to kind of go around the horn and see what people have to say. I'd like to bring in Will Hurst, who was often been discussed on the show, usually in the form of, I was with my friend Hurst and we were on his yacht. There was always something going on.
Well, he was the best man at our wedding.
Yes. Will, in the morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Adam. Good to see you. Hi, Mimi.
So, I didn't know that you were best man at their wedding, and I knew that you hung out with John a lot. I actually don't think I knew that the friendship was that deep and so tight.
Well, I think we met, I came out to work on the newspaper in the 1970s, and by the mid-1980s, I was in a more senior position there, and I was looking to hire somebody to write about technology. And I forget how John and I met, but he didn't want to do that, but he did introduce me to John Markoff, who was a writer for Byte magazine. And Markoff became our technology writer, and then he left us to go to work for the New York Times, and he became the lead technology writer there. So John had a very good eye for talent. And I remember going to his house over in Albany, and there was a whole bunch of computer stuff all over the place, kind of like a warehouse. And I'm not making a critical comment because my house is like that too. But John, you know, had people sending him stuff all the time because they wanted him to review the technology and write it up. He was kind of like a combination of Herb Kane and Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher all in one. If John thought you had an interesting product, the sales took off. And if he thought it was a dud, you might as well forget about it. He could be very snarky. I remember there was
wait, snarky? Are you kidding me? Dvorak snarky? What?
Well, he was straight, you know, he was honest and blunt and did not worry too much about your feelings if he thought the product was no good. I remember there was a guy that had a board that you could put in a PC. And this was pretty early days, so this used to have a separate board for a parallel interface and a serial interface and a sound card and a memory card. This guy had sort of a super card that had all the interfaces on and everything, and you could tell John wasn't terribly impressed, and John said to him, "What are you going to name this product?" And the guy said, "Well, I think I was going to call it the Blue Whale." Ah. And John said, "I think you should call it the White Elephant because it's never going to sell." Yeah. So he was, and I remember he told me when we were talking about all the stuff in his house, and he said, "Well, I'm going to write about something called the agony of owning junk." And I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Well, you just can't get rid of stuff because you think you might use it, or maybe if somebody gave it to you that you still haven't gotten around to it." And when I look at my own house, I think of John every time as his phrase, "the agony of owning junk," because that's what happens to you when you get to be our age.
That, you know, that is so good, and I have a closet from hell as well, and of course. We have, you know, I've only been to John's house once. I was only invited once, was for Thanksgiving dinner. And I remember saying, "Hey, man, can I see your studio?" "No." "What you mean? I can't. No. I have never seen his studio ever. And Mimi, you're sitting in it right now.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to see this. It'll scar you for life.
You will never see it.
Hey, JC, how you doing? Good morning to you.
It might be surprising, but not great.
Wow, chip off the old block. Yes, I hear you. Wow, I want to bring in Dana Brunetti as well, who is a mere associate executive producer of the No Agenda show. We pester him about this endlessly. But of course, we love having Dana in No Agenda Nation. And he and John became vast friends.
John would scold you for calling me an associate producer.
For calling you an associate? Yeah, he would. Are you, Dana, can you just check and make sure you're on your...
I had to jump off. I had to jump over to the phone because the mic died. So I'm letting it charge and I'll try it again in a little bit if you want to come back.
No, it's fine. I got you good, man. So how did you meet John? I mean, how did you hear about the show even?
So it started during COVID when I was starting to build my ranch and moved from LA to get the hell out of there. And I'd known John from Tech TV and CNET and all of his writing in the past and Cranky Geeks. And as I was constantly going around listening to podcasts and running out of things to listen to or things that were just super woke at the time that were just driving me insane, I decided to check to see if Cranky Geeks was still around. And I was planning on listening to it or riding on the tractor or whatever, and couldn't find it. And so I started searching on John C. Dvorak, and No Agenda came up. And I was like, Adam Curry and John Dvorak, that can't be the same one. Adam Curry is from MTV. This is, what is this? And I put it on, and I was like, oh, holy crap, these guys are not woke at all. Which was completely opposite of what I thought from just knowing him from Twit and Leo Lepore. And I was like, it was so refreshing. I just got addicted to the show and started listening to it. And then I finally donated and wrote in. And he sent me a note shortly after that. And we just started conversing back and forth. And he had just such a witty sense of humor.
Uh-oh. Are you still there? Yep.
Uh-oh, he fell off the tractor.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Oh, no, Dana, get back on the tractor. Let's bring in Marty for a second. Now, Marty, I don't think I've ever even spoken to Marty.
Right, Marty was one of my friends that John took over. He was from I knew him from the comedy days in the city. And the second they met, they were just thick as thieves. And, you know, I hardly got a word in edgewise.
Marty, welcome! Welcome to this special episode. Oh. I only knew you as John's joke writer, which I'd always like. Oh, what did Marty give you that gag? Oh man, back to the drawing board.
It's a pleasure to be with all of you folks right now. John's been on my mind for the last couple of days here. Last night was rough. A lot of memories, a lot of videos that we've got here, and audio tapes and things that we created together. John had a personality that just tickled me because he would take a wild idea and figure out how we could do it. And he was forever inserting me into positions where I could be very wealthy, and I'd screw it up because I'd have fun doing it. And I think I told him five times I could have been, somebody big. And it wasn't in me, you know. I did the pilot show for CNET and coordinated with John and got Leo and the people around the table and cut that video, and then had a falling out with Halsey Minor, who was the...
That wasn't hard to do.
No, it wasn't. And in fact, we had lunch down south the market. He goes, we're thinking maybe we'll have the main show right here in the Castro. And I said, well, that'll definitely send a message. And he cocked his eye, and I knew I was done.
Yeah.
It was that was it. And John appreciated that. And at the same time, he goes, John said, I went to their house where they were living out there in Pacific Heights, I believe. And he says that the only problem with the place is they didn't have enough statues of themselves. And I that's such a delicious way of putting it. John had an incredible sense of humor, a great sense of timing. I went through all kinds of changes, directed theater, had a film company, made kid films, worked at an ad agency, went up to Microsoft, and I used to steal everything from the development teams and send it down to John so he could get a first look at it. And I was all over the map, and that was okay with John, because when we talk, we'd talk about Oswald Spengler, we'd talk about modern art, talk about where music is going, what the hell's wrong with Vegas, and some of the best things I ever created or wrote were things that I batted back and forth with John. He had a remarkable talent. He was... in that way, he was a polymath. He knew a little bit about everything, and he was an expert on it, just by knowing a little about it, which I used to say he's grumpy, but he's like my uncle. He's avuncular, so maybe he's grumpy vuncular.
I think, you know? I think everybody had that vibe, yeah, with John. Hey, Mimi, yeah. I hate to do this, Mimi, but...
Turn down your speakers!
Well, I'm used to do it. I need earphones.
Yes, I appreciate earphones. One of the one things we never agreed upon was please.
I know.
So if you can turn them down just a little bit, that'd be great.
We're trying. We're okay. Trying.
Dana, are you back on?
Am I here? I don't know.
Oh yeah, you're coming in 5x5.
Okay. This clean feed on the iPhone is I keep hitting on my ear. If John was using this, he'd be complaining about it up and down. It's got to be the interface is a little wonky.
Now, from what I understand is, I mean, you and John would talk, you and your wife, Alex, and John, and probably Mimi as well, would talk regularly.
Yeah, I could wait every day. I'd wake up. Either you'd either be a text message or a Twitter message or X message or Instagram, or not much Instagram, but he would either send me something on Twitter, a text, or email. Usually email, but I could never. And then if I tried to text back, it would never work because he wouldn't get it for some reason. But
his phone was in the drawer. Of course he wouldn't get your text.
Transmit.
But we spoke like probably minimum once a week, probably 2-3 times a week sometimes on the busier times. But he would always, I realized he was like a night owl. He was never up in the mornings whenever I tried to call him, but always late at night. And usually I'd be in bed and the phone ring and it would say John C. Dvorak, and I'd say to Alex, it's John. And she would always say, answer it, because she was always mesmerized about what he had to say. And he was... Alex always said he would be her phone-a-friend if she was ever on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, because he knew everything and had a story about everything.
Yeah.
And we would always, whenever her and I would get into disagreements or arguments, we'd be like, let's call John. Rather than Google it or whatever, he was our ass Jeeves. It's let's call John. And so we'd call John, and no matter what he was doing, he would stop if he answered the phone. And he pretty much always answered the phone. It was always, hello. And just straight to it, it ring like once, and I would all. And sometimes it didn't even. And sometimes it didn't even ring. And I'm like, "How did you even know?" It was like a quarter of a ring. And he was like, "Oh, I don't know." And he was always on a cordless phone that had horrible static that he always denied, and would say, "I don't know. It sounds fine on my end." I'm like, "I'm going to record this so you can hear what I'm talking about."
Welcome to my life. He always said, "I didn't change anything. I didn't do anything. I have nothing to do with it."
But yeah, so it was, I mean, we spoke constantly, and then we started having some very expensive dinners that I paid for, of course.
Absolutely.
Whenever I was in the Bay Area, and usually when I was there for a horse show with Alex or just happened to be in the area, I'd always stop by. And then I remember on a show one time, he I think you asked him, said, how do you consider a friend? And he's like, somebody you've had dinner with and dinner at their house.
Yep.
And I remember telling him, I go, hey, I thought we were friends. He's like, we are friends. What do you mean? I'm like, I've never had dinner at your house. He's like, well, then come over. And eventually I went over with Alex, and we had dinner with Brennan and Jay at his house. And the same thing happened to me. I'm like, all right, at the end of the dinner, things are winding down. I'm like, all right, can I see the studio? And he was like, no way. I'm like, I'm here, right here. It's somewhere within feet from me. Can I see the studio? And he absolutely refused. I thought he was joking initially, but then I realized, no, he's not joking. He's not going to let me see the studio.
Mimi, why was that? Why were we not allowed to see John's studio?
Wait, before that, as a child, I couldn't see the studio.
JC, his own flesh and blood?
Yeah, so when I, up until like, I was like 10, it was like, you can't come in here. Doors closed.
Wow.
And I tried, as a very young child, I tried all sorts of tactics, such as, I can't sleep, and they would be working at night, because he works at night. And so the door would be closed. I'd sit at the stairs and be like, hey, I'm a 6-year-old who won't listen to anybody. And the door would open, and then I would go towards it, and then stopped immediately. So the office was sort of like this sacred internal, the inner sanctum of a wizard. The secrets are in there.
You are definitely keeping the myth and the legend alive, JC. Yeah. I love that. Hey, Will, could you... If you have it in you, could you give me one of your favorite JCD stories?
Oh, I do remember one time we had a editor at the paper who was who's kind of famous for maybe being a heavy drinker.
Hold on, I lost you there, Will.
Knows a lot about technology, and we don't really have a good technology writer. Markov had left. We had some people that were good, but they weren't as good. And John said, "Okay, I'll go and talk to the guy." And I called him. I saw him the next day at the newspaper, and I said, "Oh, how did the meeting go?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, the meeting was scheduled for 11 o'clock, and he didn't show." And I said, "Oh, that's just what do you think happened?" He said, "Oh, you know, I know who the guy is. So he's probably still throwing up at 11." And so, so John was very nonplussed. He never did meet the editor I wanted him to meet. Never did get the job, and he didn't care. But
that is
he could be quite a wit.
So typical. So typical.
Oh my,
Marty, you got one for us.
Well, you know, I wanted to crack up John, and it was tough to do because a lot of times he'd just smirk and give me another variation of whatever wisecracker joke I was saying. But there was one time he had a problem with his water heater on the second floor, and he says, "You got to take a look at it. It's leaking. I don't know what's wrong with it." I said, "Okay, hang on." I go up and I look, and there's a pan under it to catch the water. The bottom was rusted out. I said, "Yeah, it's shot. You need a new water heater." And he goes, "What would cause something like that?" And I got real close to his ear, and I whispered the plural of the N-word. And he just started laughing his ass off. He couldn't believe I said that.
Oh, my goodness.
But I caught him unaware just for a minute. Just for a minute.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, please. Go ahead, Marty. Go ahead.
No, you know what? We talk about comedy and comedy in the 50s and the 60s. And he knew everyone. He knew all the routines and everything. And he had internalized a lot of it with the identity of the characters like Jackie Vernon and Bill Dana and all those early comics. And he knew their routines inside out. And what he'd do is he'd wait for you to say something, and he'd just pick the right punchline and throw it out. And that's all he had to do. He could tell jokes just by telling the punchlines. He didn't need the setups. He really did.
Yeah.
He did it with joy. Yeah.
That really, you know, I love hearing these stories because John was very able to keep it within my lifetime of knowledge of culture and entertainment. And once in a while he'd throw something out there and be like, what is that a reference to? What is that called? Oh, everybody knows that. I don't know, John. I'm not so sure about that one. Mimi.
Yep.
What's on your heart, girl?
You know, I do have Jay next to me and Brennan as well. So you can always call on them and I'll share the mic.
I would love for them to say whatever they want to say right now. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I think that would be lovely. I'm going to swivel the mic to them.
Ah, oh, God.
Hello, Jay.
Hello.
I met you when you were 15 years old. You were a very, I think, timid 15-year-old. Didn't say much.
I'm a timid 32-year-old.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Well, I don't know about that, but you have been such an important part of the show in the past few years really, you shaped us up to such a degree with the back office stuff. I know that you and Mimi have done a lot together, but, you know, doing all the rings, doing the websites for the special promotions. It's been so amazing. I'm so thankful for what you've done all these years.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I woke up at 5 a.m. to do the notes and the spreadsheet for the show, and the amount of love and support that we received was crazy, and I was working up until 11.
Yeah, I have a feeling.
So a solid 6 hours
we'll be typing it up. Yeah, we'll be doing the show for a while today just to get through all of them. But we really want to make sure that everybody had a chance to say what they feel they want to say. Because as I said in my intro, we really are one big family. And I think people also see you as part of that. You know, I know that people email you because they'll tell me oh, I already talked to Jay. Everything's all cool. Everything's all safe. You must have ongoing correspondence with a lot of our No Agenda family.
do, yeah. I have back and forth with them all the time. They're all wonderful. Eli the coffee guy is really sweet. He sent a little care package to me and Brennan. Decaf coffee.
Oh, yes.
I have to live in caffeine. Yes. And, yeah, it's...
And actually, Brennan, the deadbeat, is here.
My husband, the deadbeat, is here.
Hello, Brennan. I think I've already apologized profusely. I did think it was really cool when I... Yeah, I was joking, of course. Like, hey, how's your deadbeat son-in-law? And John, the next show is like, this is actionable. Actionable? You're going to sue me over this? This is actionable? You have to do something about this? How you doing, Brennan?
I'm doing great, and I love the nickname deadbeat. To get a nickname is a badge of honor.
This is true. Know? But you really had a great connection with John, because when he was staying at your house after the surgery, you know, after the show, you know, very different dynamic, because you and Jay would come in, and I would hear him talking to you. I'm like, wow, he really loves this guy. You had a great relationship with him. I could tell.
Oh, yeah. We had from the very start, you know, when I first started seeing Jay, you got to meet him. He wants to have dinner with you. That's his litmus, right? And he sat me down, and the very first question he asked me was, how do you feel about Bordeaux? And then he poured half a bottle of cognac down my throat, basically. Uh-huh.
I held you, I believe. I held you back so you would have your mouth open.
It's an interrogation technique.
It's an interrogation technique. And he kept me interrogated for a long time. And
I don't think we stopped, actually.
No, never did.
And we did a background search on him, and, you know.
Yes, I'm sure you did.
I came up mostly clean, except for that weird stuff. But, you know, he and I really, really got to bond quite a lot in the last 20 weeks, especially. But, I mean, I had dinner with him every week. And, you know, I was his gopher. I was his driver.
Well, let's explain. John insisted that we have a family dinners every Friday. Well, first it was every Friday.
Move a little closer, Mimi.
We're sharing a mic. So we're putting our heads together like we're the three
Stooges. Yes.
There you go. So, John was big about family. So for as long as I've known him, it's always been we had to have family, you know, sit-down dinners. So, you know, so anybody that unfortunately Jay dated or JC dated or even Eric dated would have to, you know, come and get the John Dvorak treatment.
Yes.
Or as Marty called it, the Dvorak syndrome.
Thank you. And John would grill you. You know, and he'd never talk. He'd mostly never talk. And then one day, and then he'd get like a wild hair and just, you know, I think he needed at least two glasses of wine. And then he would really open up during dinner.
You know,
I got to drive him around everywhere for, you know, when you got a crack sternum, they don't let you drive anything.
Right.
And I got to drive him around everywhere and talk to him and chat. And, the amount of times he told me to that I should start a podcast, so maybe that I'd shut up in the car.
John was, you know, I love so much working with him because, as I said, nothing. In fact, when we ever scripted something, if we ever said, "Hey, you do this, and I'll deliver the punchline," guaranteed failure. It would always fail. I'd screw up the setup. He'd forget the punchline. Oh, we were doing that. Oh, yeah, no, I forgot about that. But when we were just on the fly doing stuff, and this as a broadcaster, I loved working with him so much because I could bring in sound effects. I could bring in, you know, we both enjoyed the art of the theater of the mind, which is why we also never did video. We said, no, we're not going to do any of this. We want people to, well, of course I did, but we want people to imagine what John's office is like. We want people to just, you know, have their mind's eye as to what's going on. And I just wanted to play, I have a couple, but one of my favorite bits, and I'm not even sure how it started, probably because people, you know, the number 33 was very important to the show. because we didn't know what it meant. 33 would show up everywhere and be like, what is this? We, you know, had many people explain it to us over the years, but we always felt it was some operation, either Operation is Go or Operation is Stop, some kind of military or PSYOP. And then people start saying, hey, you know, there's this Club 33 at Disneyland, which everyone is quite aware of. We knew that that wasn't quite the Club 33 that the No Agenda show would like. But John had an idea, and we came up with our very own Club 33.
Everybody give for Amber!
No, you already did Amber. We need another.
Oh, I got a Raven!
How do you know these things?
Straight from Reseda, here she is, Raven! Give it up! Up next, Bambi. Bambi to the stage.
Bambi to the stage. Wow, you do know it. Okay, I'll do Raven, then we get, and then we'll come back to you.
Straight from Reseda, here she is, Raven. Give it up.
All right, John, go.
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for that petite, hot bombshell, Janine, as she comes off the stage. Find her in the private dance rooms where you can live like a king with lap dances on sale. Ask for your discount coupon and free private dance card available at the bar. Buy 10 dances, get one free. Now to the main stage is Sharona. She likes dirt bikes, dirty dancing, dirty boys, and Star Trek, as Sulu would say. Oh, my Sharona. Give it up to Sharona. Shirley and Donna will be doing a lesbian act on stage 2. Bring him up. Shirley and Donna. These two hotties can be seen at the club on Wednesday Mud Wrestling. Get a lap dance today, and the girls will give you a voucher for free entrance.
Is that it?
Yeah.
That is John C. Dvorak. He could do that. He could do that off the cuff. He just threw that out there. But he had, sometimes he would have punchlines and things that just became show staples, such as this one about Speaker of the House Mike Johnson.
Oh. And I have two clips.
Oh.
Don't mind.
No. Now, what was your original position?
That the CIA or somebody came up to him and said, hey, look at this picture.
Yeah.
What's that in your mouth, you think?
Oh, John, stop now. This is a family show.
It's just a family show. Could be eating succotash. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Succotash, sure. So, dig the hole deeper.
I'm thinking. I'm rethinking my. I'm completely. No.
Wait, is this a Johnson pivot?
It's a John. I have done a Johnson. Yes, he's got the right last name for what I was talking about.
Yeah, it was such a joy when he came up with these things, and then this is another one. I mean, and so what's that in your mouth was a show title. It became a thing whenever a politician did something. Be like, hey man, what's that in your mouth? We know why you're changing your vote. We know what you're doing. And then there was this one.
Then, of course, we have a classic, a favorite, the pansexual. You know what that is, the pansexual, of course.
Yeah, yeah. You have sex with an animal.
Anything. Anything goes. Anything.
Now, this hey, what are you going to do? Hey, anyone going to eat this meatloaf? That's the pansexual.
I literally was on the floor. It was just, that was the kind of stuff that he did. But he was also, he loved giving advice. We talked a lot about, you know, young people, what should they do? The sock hop is legendary. Hey, you want to meet somebody? We'd rather bring sock hops back. And here he is with some career and management advice for young people, which I think is something we need to listen to again.
Well, here's, I got my piece of advice.
All right.
I've given this advice before. I'm going to give it again. Most people that will supervise you throughout your careers are full of crap.
And that's the advice. The more you know.
And they tend to they can be played, and I don't like to say that you want to play people, but they can be played by just going along with whatever they have to say. Do not be argumentative. And I'll give two examples. I'll give one example, a good one. I'll generalize. Somebody will say, hey, I don't like the way you're doing this. And you're doing it whatever way you're doing it. And you, instead of saying, well, I'm doing it for this reason or that reason or whatever, you say, okay, what do you want me to do? What do you think I should do better? I'm all ears. Be very attentive. And then they'll tell you the way they want you to do something. And then just keep doing it the way you were doing it because it's the way you do things. Don't pay any attention to their advice. And within, I don't know, a few months, they come back to you and say, well, so how's that new way of doing things? And you say, it's great. You were right. And the guy will say, yep, I've noticed it. You've changed. You're much better than you were. And that happens all the time because everybody thinks they're so important.
Interesting. That's not the kind of advice I give. I give different advice. Because I give the same advice. Is that the same advice you hand out to young people all the time?
No, I have a lot of different advices.
Oh.
But that one particular piece of advice, which is these supervisors are full of crap. And just to go along with the program, don't argue. That's my
stay in line.
but keep doing things the way you're doing them. It's not gonna. They're not gonna notice one. They don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I guess my advice kind of dovetails into that. Where my advice is always the same: find out what you really like doing. What you really like doing. Just there's something you like doing. You could be skateboarding for all I care. Find something you really, really what you really love doing. And then find someone to pay you to do it. That's the secret to life.
Ideal advice for everybody, but many times
anybody can do that.
You
have a place in life.
A job tomorrow, and you have to go work at Taco Bell. What are you going to do? Screw you, Taco Bell.
Well, that's part of the finding someone to pay you to do it part.
Yeah, well, you maybe can do that from the taco back in the. Try to get in the front counter.
It's taken me 54 years to finally be able to podcast. Don't knock it.
And that was so true. I have my entire second half of life career to thank to this man. The way we set up value for value, the way we made it all work, which a lot of that was him, a lot of these ideas, a lot of the, hey, we got to keep hammering people that otherwise it won't work. I remember when we, maybe it was around the second year, I was in a hotel room in New York and we were just doing the podcast and we were asking for value for value. And he called me and he said, hey, we got $900 for this show. I'm like, wow, that's a lot. He said, this is going to work. Quit your job. This is going to work. We're going to do this. And we did. And we just never looked back. And I'm so thankful for him for giving me something to do as a patently unhireable person.
So, Adam, his job advice, he would give that to me, and I listened to him. So he'd tell me to do things a certain way, and I'd go, uh-huh.
I just want to talk about wine for a second. This is, you know, John introduced an entire generation to the Kirkland crate of six bottles of Bordeaux for about $3 a piece. Everybody, you know, Costco was like, oh, wow, man, these things are going fast. Let's start with Will. I'm sure you and John enjoyed a lot of exquisite and different bottles of wine together.
Oh yeah. That was one of the things that we both helped each other with our addiction problem. He introduced me to Kermit Lynch. I didn't know about that place over in Berkeley. And one of the last times I saw John was I got an invitation to go to the La Palais, which is a big Burgundy Fest in San Francisco. And my wife said, I don't want to go. It's terrible. So I ended up with two tickets. And I figured, like, well, maybe Dvorak is willing to go, particularly if I'm paying and I already have the tickets. So we went to that thing together. And it was an all-evening stuff. And it was like half the people were very wealthy, sort of technology people that knew nothing about wine. And then there were a bunch of other people that knew a lot about wine. There were a bunch of other people that were sponsors. It was a very weird collection of people. So John had a lot of fun kind of introducing me to one or two people that he knew and making some comments. But we really enjoyed ourselves. And he was always pointing out to me bargain basement wines. And I guess I'm a bit of a snob relative to John, so I would never follow up on all of his suggestions. But he had a very good palate and could very quickly make comments about wine that were quite accurate. So
yeah, it was.
I missed that. He was a good buddy to have a glass of wine with.
He was also the guy you could text him a wine label or a wine menu, and within 3 minutes he would text you back, no matter what time of the day. Because John, I could. There's emails in his inbox, hundreds of mine he's never read, because I didn't see that. Didn't come in. I didn't see it. But if you texted him something like, "Hey man, what wine should I choose?" Boom, and it was always like this. He'd say, "Okay, no wine should be more than $40." Like, okay, no, that's just ridiculous. And then he'd find one and he'd point one out. Even when back in the early days, I'd come into San Francisco, we'd have lunch at Fringal, I would say, probably his favorite haunt. And I'd say, "Hey man, I got the company credit card. Let's just go crazy." He wouldn't do it. Like, no, this is always on the price. That's too expensive. They're charging too much. We're not going to drink that. Dana, how about you?
That is a complete opposite.
Really?
He never once. I remember getting the bill on a few dinners and was shocked because he always had the wine list and would order. So I was like, "Get whatever," because you know wine better than I do. And that was not the case on our dinners.
Maybe he adapted. Maybe it was just one of those, "I'll adapt to this guy's budget." Oh, that's so cool.
No, he was just introduce Dana to better wines. He was trying to up his palate. That's what John did.
He did send me notes. Order a case of this. This is good stuff. It's cheap. Order this. So I had boxes and boxes, and then eventually I couldn't keep up with it. But we did go to a wine tasting once at a. We went to a vineyard. It was actually somebody from No Agenda was like the PR person at this winery, and John. He's like, "Let's go." So we went, and they had the winemaker there, and they had a whole setup, a tent set up for us, and did a whole dinner. And it was really, it was beautiful and lovely. But one of the funniest things was he was there with the winemaker, this French guy, debating the wines with the guy who made the wines.
It's no good.
Like, "John, I think this guy knows what he's talking about. Oh. He made it." No. The tannins on this one is... why the winemaker is right there next to him.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Well, John was a taster for Bon Appetit. I mean, he was invited to events all the time to be one of the... he did that. He was really a student of wine. I mean, you could throw out a year in a maker and he would just tell you, "Well, you know what that tasted like," and he could describe it, and it was really interesting. I mean, it's a wonder I'm not a full blown alcoholic.
So can I sneak one thing in here?
Yeah, please.
The Consumer Electronics Show in 2000. John and I went down there because he was on a kick about going global. Everything's going global. So he wanted to go from booth to booth and get people to talk about what they thought going global meant. And we wound up getting a bunch of silly answers and a little crowd of people who followed him around, who I think were like deep pocket money or investors. And one of them said, "We should have dinner." John said, "Yeah, we'll have dinner. We'll go to the Bellagio." And we all went to the Bellagio, and John got the wine list, and those poor guys, I have to tell you, I think it was about $8,500 worth of wine.
Yeah,
and
perfect.
And each one that came out, another bottle would be about like $300, $400 bottle of wine. He'd go, "Oh, this one's great. You're going to love this." And he'd pour it for them. He got them drunk. He had them pay for dinner. It was hilarious. What a great dinner. And it was John in his prime. Just rolling out the details about the wine and the taste. "This one has a big nose." They said, "Does it have a fright wig and big shoes? It might be a clown wine." Joking around with them. And we're realizing we're skinning these guys alive. It was I will never forget that in my entire life.
You know,
what a joy.
But later, John didn't really travel much, Mimi. He kind of liked to stay home. I know that sometimes he would have, he always talked about having some speaking engagement. He's on his way to the airport, realizes he's forgot his belt, went back and just wouldn't get on the plane.
Huh. Well, you know, that for, you know, our, being self-employed forever, you know, we had to can sometimes scramble because, you know, our income could, you know, dive unexpectedly, significantly. So at one point when all the magazines started going out of business, I started putting them on a speaking tour. And at one point I was having him do like 4 keynotes a month and then another 12 other speaking things.
You're like the momager. So what's going on here?
He wasn't pleased. I can say that. So, you know, he kind of got, but he did travel. He traveled all over the world. I mean, he went on junkets everywhere. He did travel extensively. At a certain point, he said, there's nowhere else I really want to see. So
I've seen it all. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, and I never liked to travel. So, you know, that was fine with me. I'm not a good traveler. So John, you know, he would wear people ragged when he would go on these trips with them. Cause you know, he'd have PR people just like, well, I want to do this. And I want to like, well, if I'm going to Finland, I want to ride a reindeer. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was definitely someone to try to keep up with. I mean, even when we would go on a family trip, you know, we went to, our longest trip was to South Africa. And I've got 2 kids in tow. I'm in coach. John's first class because South Africa is paying for the trip.
The nation of South Africa?
Huh?
The nation of South Africa was paying for the trip?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Yes. Nice.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, I was always afraid of getting lost at the airport because he would just walk like he was by himself. So he'd be like a mile ahead of me. And I'd be, you know, with the bags and the kids. Slow down.
One of the wonderful things John would talk about is the many, many jobs he had. And it never ceased to amaze what job he had had, right down to can inspector. That was another one of my favorites. But I egged him on all the time to tell this story because it's about his job as an air pollution inspector and a famous politician.
From now on, she's Barbara Boxster.
She's the one, as you recall, that used to try to pick up the air pollution inspectors.
Oh, do tell the story again, John.
You really want me to tell you?
Yes, yes, because yes.
We had 2 people, a member of the board, the regional air pollution board. One of them was Boxer and one was Feinstein. And I have these 2 anecdotes about both of them. But the Boxer one was the most interesting because after one of the meetings, she would always try to solicit one of the air pollution inspectors. We all had cars.
And you were an air inspection.
I'm an expert on air pollution, yes. Believe it or not.
Yeah, I believe.
So. We had these cars, and she would find somebody, okay, can I get a ride home? And all the guys would bitch about this because she'd make a pass at everybody trying to get him in the sack.
Now, she's not, certainly back in the day, I think she's doable.
Well, she still wears kind of whorish makeup.
Yeah, but that's what's so great about it.
Yes, but imagine this being 25 or longer years ago, a long time ago, she would look pretty good.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And I think she probably was, but it was very annoying. Nobody wanted to take her driver. It was like everyone would scatter. She looks. When she came out of these meetings.
She looks kind of like a news anchor. You know, she's sexy. Did she? How's her body? Was it okay back then?
I don't know. I never fucked her.
Hey.
Whatever the case, it would be the funniest thing to watch everyone scatter, jump in their cars and drive off as fast as they could.
Hey man, I got to pick up the kids.
Soon everyone took off.
It looks like she had dark hair back in the day.
She still does.
No, she's like blondish, darkish blonde. Anyway, so
black hair, as I recall.
All right, so she is a super duper Obama bot, and here's her contribution.
Oh, yeah, she's dumb, by the way. That's a real problem.
Wait a minute. How about Feinstein? Was she whorish too?
No, not at all.
No, okay.
And she, but she was a not just the opposite. She was very prudish, and she was. Just, but she was also. She was. I would say she was even dumber.
Well, listen. You can't fix stupid. We all know that. That's what we say here in Texas.
It was a rare F bomb from John C. Dvorak. And we would always catch each other on stuff, you know, if we were constantly saying something like fact of the matter or anyway or whatever it was, we would always be checking each other on the show. Oh, you said it. Oh, we're going to. Oh, no, you got to stop saying that. It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience to be in conversation with him for almost 6-7 hours a week.
So actually, you know, him being an air pollution inspector is why I picked the funeral home, because he used to inspect it because it's also a crematorium.
No, no.
Hey, you know, if he gave it a clean bill of health, I was going to go for it.
So if you don't, there is going to be a friends and family memorial, I believe. You want to tell us what's happening?
Well, we need to plan it, so we'll figure it out by Sunday when I speak to you again. We're going to have we're having a friends and family memorial that we're sending out invitations to, and then we're going to have a public one for everyone. But we have to put it together, and distracted.
Yes, it also seems like a lot of people are already organizing meetups in his honor, which I think is a great way to do it. I love that people are doing that. I think we lost Will. I'm not sure if he's coming back or not. I do want to share.
Is JC still there?
Yeah, JC's
Hello.
Here. Yes, JC's here.
So talk, JC.
I